Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Stephen King Cast, one man's musings on the work of Stephen King. Each week, I will review one of Stephen King's works in the chronological order of publication, but today we will be discussing Tobe Hooper's 1979 TV movie adaptation of King's second novel, Salem's Lot. So before we get into that, I would just like to take a few moments to go over the viewer, listener emails and Facebook comments that I've received so far, because like I've said time and time again, I don't want this to be just me. I want this to be an ongoing conversation. I really can't do this without hearing your thoughts and your feedback and anything that you might disagree that I have to say. So I'm just going to take a few moments to read what you've told me so far. So I've been very grateful that some people actually have reached out and written to me. So if you want to share some of your thoughts on either any of my views or analyses that I have given so far, or if you just want to share your own experience with a particular novel or short story that I reviewed, or, you know, you can just tell me what Stephen King means to you, how you wound up getting into this world, all of these things I would like to be able to just read and just be able to share, you know, with others. So you can reach out to me at StephenKingCast@yahoo.com. I'm currently on Instagram at Stephen KingCast. The Twitter handle is Stephen KingCast. I'm on Facebook, Stephen KingCast. So if you just do any sort of search on social media for Stephen KingCast, you're going to find it. So the first is from Jack. And Jack writing was huge because this is evidence that Stephen KingCast has gone global. He's writing from the UK. So he writes, "I'm Jack from SK_fans on Instagram. I listened to episode one of your podcast this morning and I loved it. I'll definitely be following your podcast and I really hope you continue growing and have lots of listeners." Well, thank you, Jack. "Anyways, you asked me what King means to me. Well, I picked up my first King book a few years ago while in Scotland. I wasn't a book reader at all, and decided I wanted to try reading for on the train home. Not knowing about any of his books or the stories he wrote, I recognized his name when in a bookstore, and I bought Cell. Of course, I didn't realize what classics I could have bought, because I never knew how good his works are. Cell took me 1 week to finish, and I really enjoyed it, and I wanted to read more of King after seeing the amount of books of his in the store. After that, my uncle, who was a huge King fan, gave me The Shining, and from then on, my love for King was cemented despite only reading two of his books. I kept on reading and reading as many as I could get my hands on, and it got me through most of high school. I felt like I had an advantage over everybody else in my year because, and you'd be surprised, very few teenagers read books for pleasure, and my mind all day was set on King's stories. It had completely brainwashed me. I got up an hour early every day to read a King book with a cup of coffee. I stayed up all night to the early hours of the morning. I was crazy about them. Earlier this year for my birthday, my nan brought me all of the books in the Dark Tower series. I was very much daunted by the amount of books and the size of some of them, but I read The Gunslinger, and from that point on, I couldn't stop. My mind, all day and every day, is set on Roland and his quartet. I set myself up a routine of reading 50 pages minimum each day, and most days even read more. I have never and probably never will read anything as good as the series, and it has permanently set King as my favorite author, along with my other epic favorites of his, such as The Stand, Under the Dome, and 11/22/63. So, sorry for rambling on, and you don't need to apologize, Jack. King has kept me so engrossed in a book that I never thought I could be. His books have made reading a permanent hobby for me, and his work has made me grateful that I am not in the situation that he tends to put a lot of his characters in. King has become a huge inspiration to me, and now I take pride in owning all of his work on my Kindle. Unfortunate circumstance has forced me to sell all my physical books. That would make a good horror story. Sorry for such a long email. Again, you don't need to apologize. Anyways, I look forward to listening to your podcast, and I really hope it becomes a huge success for you." So that's Jack, and thank you, Jack, for writing in. Your experience is very similar to, you know, how I wound up, you know, getting involved with you know, the works of Stephen King.
all it took was just one. And then from then on there, it was just one after the other, after the other, after the other. So I'm so glad that you wrote to me. Thank you. And then also in this email, I think that for a lot of us, you know, we read our Stephen King novels, and there's the gateway Stephen King novel, and that differs from person to person. For me, it was It. You know, for others, it would have been at the beginning with Carrie. Maybe it was The Shining. Maybe it was one of his newer ones. But we all start somewhere. And then from there, we start to work our way through, you know, I would say his classics, or the ones that are closest physically to us to actually pick up and start reading, or the one that was recommended. But the more we start to get into the world of Stephen King, the more we start to hear about The Dark Tower. And I know that for me, it was a little daunting, and I had heard about it, and it almost had a mythic stature, because at that time, it wasn't completed yet. I knew that it was something he had been working on for a period of years. I know that it was described as being very weird, and that intrigued me. And as I started to read it and put the pieces together, I realized that he was drawing from different stories that he had already written. And I'll definitely get into this more once I start the review of The Gunslinger. My interest was hooked immediately. And as the years went on, I poured through each of Stephen King's novels. I was looking for clues in The Dark Tower. I just couldn't wait for each installment of the Dark Tower saga. So I think that with the Dark Tower fans, I think, like I've said before, that's the highest level of Stephen King fans that we have. I'm currently rereading The Gunslinger for the Stephen King cast for an upcoming review, and it's still daunting, but, you know, at the same time, it also feels like you are stepping into a very comfortable pair of well-worn cowboy boots, so to speak. So Jack, again, thank you for writing in, and, you know, if you are a fan of Stephen King, you know, you can post anything with SK_fans, and Jack will put up your stuff on Instagram. Thank you, Jack, and thank you for all the support, and, you know, any other thoughts that you might have, you know, please feel free to continue to send emails so I can share them with the rest of our constant reader fan base. So our next mail comes from fellow podcast host Kat, whose work you can find on boysandghouls.podbean.com, in which she and co-host Marshall talk all things horror. Kat writes, "Just left you a review, and I wish it counted times a million. I love, love, love what you're doing. I grew up with a mother who was a member of the SK Book Club. She still is, and she kept all of his books on one bookshelf. I was pretty much allowed to read anything I wanted, and SK is a huge reason why I got so deeply into horror. The short stories Here There Be Tigers and The Raft were two I read over and over, mesmerized by their ability to scare me with only words. Of course, I realized after a short amount of time that everything he writes is so much more about the characters, and I have been destroyed over and over again, loving and mourning my favorite characters. And I keep coming back for more. And I got my first SK tattoo last October. It's the Ka symbol, and it's huge, like my love for Uncle Steve. I've been thinking for a while that, while SK's name is certainly a part of the cultural zeitgeist, people aren't thinking and talking about him like they used to. Thanks for throwing your thoughts into the mix. I hope they'll lead to some new constant readers into worlds they couldn't have imagined. Thanks again, and please keep going." So that to me, first of all, is an incredible email, and thank you so much. And Kat also went and wrote an incredible iTunes review, so I'm very, very grateful for that. But, you know, her saying that he's not in the zeitgeist the way that he used to be when I was growing up certainly reaffirms the reasons why I'm doing this. So one reason, like I said in previous podcasts, is because I just wanted to create the kind of podcast that I myself would like to listen to. The second reason is because he isn't talked about the way that he used to be, and I want people to. George R. R. Martin is like the number one writer right now. And then, you know, young adult fiction is all of the rage. So people are talking about literature, people are talking about books, people are talking about authors, but they're not talking about Stephen King the way that they used to. So, you know, thank you, Kat, for sharing. And, you know, I think that having the Ka symbol definitely is your love letter to Stephen King. And I imagine that there's a lot of people out there, if they saw the tattoo, they wouldn't know what it is. And having it out there is definitely it's like a secret code to us Stephen King fans. So, you know, again, thank you. And if anyone wants to listen to some more musings on this genre, head on over to boysandghouls.podbean.com. And up next, we have Dwayne, whose subject heading showed me, here's a guy who wears his Stephen King fandom like a badge of honor, proudly boasting his love of the Dark Tower with the famous greeting among King fans, thank you, Cy. Dwayne writes, hello, I just wanted to drop you a quick line to say that I love the podcast. I listened to all three episodes today. Great stuff. You really know your King. My first experience with King was likely through one of his movie adaptations, but I cannot remember which film. My first King novel was Cujo at age 14. 22 plus years later, and I'm still addicted. It is my all-time favorite novel, period. I read it 3 times in my teen years. That book in particular registered with me in many ways. Reading the novel at that time in my life, I felt like I was the unofficial 8th member of the Losers Club, and I wanted to be with these kids even if it meant certain death at the hands of Pennywise. Oh, how our imaginations were so fertile in our youth. Anyway, I'd love to start an open dialogue about all things King. It's difficult to find someone as passionate about his work as I am. I appreciate your thought-provoking analysis thus far on the podcast. Even more so, I appreciate your positivity towards the Kingverse. So many others will nitpick about every single detail and try and find fault in everything. So far, all of your critiques have been valid points. So thank you. Thank you so much for that. That's a huge compliment. And then he writes, and you actually liked Carrie 2013. I thought I was the only one. Sincerely, Dwayne. So thank you, Dwayne. Thank you for writing out. And your experience with It is very similar to my own. And I wonder how many people out there had the same type of experience with It. Because like I said on the first podcast, and I'll definitely get back into when I eventually, you know, get to the review of It. But when I read that, I was the age of the kids. And yeah, I wanted to be a member of the Losers Club. I felt that by reading it, that being that age, and with the ability of King to write about childhood so well, I felt like I was the unofficial member of that group. And same thing, I just felt like they were my friends. And I felt like when we lost some of them, I was losing a friend. And that is a testament to his ability. And, you know, same thing. I would have wanted to have been a part of that group, even if it meant that I would have to face against Pennywise, because at least I'd be facing against Pennywise with those friends. That's how I felt about It. And Dwayne, that sounds like very much, you know, how you felt about Stephen King as well. So thank you again for the very kind words, and that you have a fellow Carrie 2013 fan. Wasn't a huge fan, don't get me wrong, I wasn't a huge fan, but I definitely did appreciate many elements of it. And then the author Joe Sherry on Facebook, on the Facebook page, writes, love the Salem's Lot episode, lots of great insights. I thought I'd mention that the house as a battery concept comes from Matheson's Hell House, an author I think King might be a little familiar with, which I think is a great valid point. Good catch, Joe. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to read the Wikipedia description on Hell House. Hell House is a 1971 novel by Richard Matheson, author of I Am Legend, The Shrinking Man, What Dreams May Come, and classic Twilight Zone episodes such as Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. The story concerns four people: Dr. Lionel Barrett, a physicist with an interest in parapsychology, his wife Edith, and two mediums, Florence Tanner, a spiritualist and mental medium, and Benjamin Franklin Fisher, a physical medium, who are hired by a dying millionaire, William Reinhardt Deutsch, to investigate the possibility of life after death. To do so, they must enter the infamous Belasco House in Maine, regarded as the most haunted house in the world. The house is called Hell House due to the horrible acts of blasphemy and perversion that occurred there under the silent influence and supervision of Americ Belasco. Fisher is the only supervisor of a failed investigation attempt 30 years earlier. The novel combines supernatural horror with mystery as the researchers attempt to investigate the haunting of the house while their sanity is subtly determined by its sinister supernatural influence. During the investigation, various influences begin to affect each character's personal weaknesses. Florence, through her belief in spiritualism and over-eagerness to rid the house of its evil. Dr. Barrett, through his almost arrogant disbelief in disregard for spiritualism, his belief in science, and debilitated physical condition, having suffered from polio when young. Edith, through her personal fears, insecurities, and pent-up desires. And Fisher, through his deliberate inaction, which he calls caution. Hell House's potency comes from its apparent ability to corrupt those who enter its walls before bringing about their destruction, both mental and physical. So if you like this concept of the Marston House in Salem's Lot, then go out and pick up this classic by master author Richard Matheson. Now, while you're out book shopping, if you want a little zombie in your life to tide you over till the premiere of The Walking Dead, I strongly recommend So Long and Thanks for All the Brains, an anthology of short stories all involving zombies, including a story entitled OCD, written by Joe, who made the connection between the Marston and Hell House and posted on Facebook. OCD is a great read, and I wish I could tell you more about it, but anything I could say would give it away, and I wouldn't want to ruin the experience for you. So, again, strongly recommend So Long and Thanks for All the Brains, which you can find on Amazon currently for $15.29. It's a great price for a good chunk of zombie stories, and again, OCD is the one that you want to look out for. And last but not least, I want to read the first iTunes review, which was submitted by comic book artist John Cordes. John writes, "I'll keep this short and sweet. A lot of podcasts out there are just filler and don't provide any real analysis or critique. This one offers something of both old and new readers, a knowledgeable analysis of King's work, along with some personal experiences that give King's written words some actual weight. Do yourself a favor and give this one a download." So thanks, John. And everyone, you should all do yourself a favor and check out his weekly webcomic, Mostache, the story of Dave Reynolds, who awakens one day to find what looks to be a mustache, but is in fact an intergalactic alien named Mo attached to his face. Dave and Mo must work together to stop an insidious invasion of the symbiotic alien race of facial-haired despots. It's a great read, it's a fun read, and you can find all of the episodes at www.mostachecomic.com. So that's what we have so far. Just thank you for writing in on the various social media sites. Instagram has been a huge source of Stephen King cast, and a lot of you I think that I've just read from found out about the Stephen King cast on Instagram. So, continue, following the goings on of the podcast on Instagram, but, feel free to just drop a line at StephenKingCast@yahoo.com. The Twitter handle is StephenKingCast. Again, it's on Instagram. There's the Facebook page, which you can go out and like right now, and it's Stephen King Cast. And there's a Pinterest also. So there's many, many options out there. I'm trying to spread the word of Stephen King Cast. So, like Kat had said, he's able to get back into the cultural zeitgeist. So thank you, everyone. I hope you enjoyed this little section here. I really want to start to include this more and more into the podcast episodes to encourage just more discussion. And I just want everyone to be able to share what Stephen King, means to you, because I think that he is, for our culture and our popular culture, he is a very, very important influence and part of it. So keep the emails coming, keep the iTunes reviews coming, and follow us on Instagram, on Twitter, on the whole nine yards, like us on Facebook, and pick up a good Stephen King book, pick up your favorite Stephen King book this fall, pick up Revival coming out on Amazon and bookstores everywhere, and early reviews are that this is a good one. So I'll look forward to reviewing that when the time comes. So that's all we got now for emails, and I just look forward to hearing what you have to say. So don't hesitate to drop me a line on the many places that I've just listed. Thank you. Okay, so now I will get into my review of the Salem's Lot TV adaptation. As you know, last week we reviewed Salem's Lot, which brings us to today's edition. I watched it last night, and just so you know, this movie cannot be found on Netflix or iTunes or Comcast, which to me tells you something about the movie itself. I don't think it's in great demand, and I don't really see why it would be. I'll just cut right to the chase. This I'm not a fan of this movie. I think that it's pretty awful. I was bored out of my mind when I was watching it, and it's not going to be the most biased or unbiased review, because I kept checking in and out, and like 10 minutes would go by, I would be surfing the net, and I would go back, and it just seems that I would still be watching the exact same scene that I checked out of. And after fast forwarding through a number of the scenes, I realized that they don't contribute anything to the narrative whatsoever. The Tobe Hooper and the screenwriter, you know, checked in on a number of the characters the way that Stephen King does in the book, but in the book it works because he's telling a story about a small town, whereas the movie, it's not about a small town, it's about, you know, the guy fighting the vampires. It's one of those things that just, it works better in a book than it does in a movie. This just never, it never finds its footing. It's kind of a mess from start to finish. But I said that I was going to do a review, and a review I will do. So I'll just, you know, I was taking some notes. I'll just go through the notes. And it starts in Mexico, much like it did in the novel. It's very quiet. We're introduced to Ben and Mark. Ben, by the way, played by David Soul, Hutch from Starsky and Hutch, who brings nothing to this character. And when I sat down to review this, I wasn't sure if I was actually going to review the 2004 TNT TV miniseries, but I remember watching that in 2004 and being bored out of my skull, so I didn't want to go back and revisit that. I didn't realize that this edition was just as boring, but I did some you know, I was bored during the 79 movie, I started looking up images and some information on the 2004 edition, and it struck me just how 2004 it looks. You know, the day and age that whatever the decade, the time period is that I live in, I always think that, you know, I'm just encapsulated by this bubble, and that I will never look back on the my hair or the style of my clothes and say, oh, that was so 2014. But yeah, I mean, there's something about all the images that I saw of the 2004 edition that just screams 2004, and I can't even put my finger on what that means. I just think that it's still a couple years removed from the late 90s and kind of has that feel, and Rob Lowe running around, it looks like Ian Somerhalder from The Vampire Diaries. But I don't know. I mean, this particular movie, the one that I reviewed last night, I mean, that screams late 70s as well. You know, specifically with Hutch's jacket with the elbow patches, which has come back in style, and I own a jacket like that and I love it. But the 2004 edition is just as much a time capsule as this particular movie is. But I digress. So we're in Mexico, quiet man and boy in the church. And what's interesting is they start bottling the holy water, and you see it automatically start glowing, which is good. You know, you see this glow on David's soul's face, the only glow that you'll see on his face the entire movie, the only expression whatsoever you're going to see on his face. Because, like I said, he brings absolutely nothing. But already it establishes a different take on what King had presented. So these two just haven't left Jerusalem's lot. They're being run down by the vampires, which I thought was interesting. Then the credits hit, and I loved the credits because it's so from another time. All right, you know, the moon is in the sky, and then you hear a wolf howl, and then the music kicks in, and we see the Marston house, and it's very piano heavy. It's good. It just makes me feel like an old Dracula movie. And I was watching, I'm like, all right, I'm like, good opening scene, great credits. This is gonna be a lot of fun. It's gonna be a fun movie, and then it's as if Tobe Hooper, you know, is this vindictive filmmaker who heard me through the rivers of time and my television and said, no, you will not have a good time. You will have whatever time I want you to have, which is definitely not a good time. We are then reintroduced to Ben as he approaches Salem's lot 2 years before we meet him in Mexico. He stops before the Marston house. He's clearly shaken. He witnesses James Mason stroll out. James Mason, who exchanges a glance with Ben before Mason drives away, which will be the first of what seem like many James Mason car driving scenes. I mean, every time I looked up, not only was he driving his car, but he wasn't looking at the road. You always hear about studio executives giving more notes to the directors. And I just couldn't help but think that they watched some of the footage and then, you know, gave some of the notes. Was this one of their notes? You know, I don't know. You know that scene that you filmed with James? Yeah. Our test audience really liked that. Can you do more of that? And what if he just keeps looking over his shoulder? Nah, it doesn't matter that no one's following him. Just more driving, more looking over his shoulder. Trust me, kid. It'll be a hit. I don't know. I don't know why he's looking over his shoulder. I don't know why, you know, I get he's supposed to be paranoid, but it was the same scene, over and over again. So one by one, we meet the townsfolk, Crockett, Straker, Gillespie, Miller and Susan Norton, in the park, a scene filmed in such a way it presents Ben as this stalker. It isn't nice. I don't know what they're trying to do, but the dude's just creeping at her from behind a tree. You know, I don't know how a reaction is to not scream and run away. But anyway, he meets Susan, played by Bonnie Bedelia. I think that she's played, you know, well by Bonnie Bedelia, who will later go on to play Polly Chalmers in Needful Things. Characters start feeling out their respective potential partners' relationship situation when Ben drops the bomb that his wife is dead. But more importantly, Susan, you didn't answer the question of whether or not you'd like to go to dinner. Somehow Hooper made me like Ben even less than the book by making him even more unfeeling at the death of his wife. Again, it has less to do with the deceased Mrs. Mears as it does with the way the storytellers couple the information of that knowledge, you know, with, hey, my wife is dead. And more importantly, you want to get something to eat? I don't know. Then it cuts to, you know, people want to know who this Ben guy is. And I think that's a humorous and clever choice for Eva and Weasel to, just deliver necessary exposition by breaking into Ben's room and reading his manuscript. And then in one of this movie's longest car rides, Susan and Ben talk about, I don't even know what they talk about because I stopped paying attention. But they wind up by a lake where he throws stones and she asks him if he's uncomfortable with her, probably because he looks like he's 20 years older than she is. But she plays the character as someone who wants to get lost in love, which I think goes a long way in my eyes in soothing the concerns that I had expressed in the previous podcast episode. But yeah, they share little chemistry whatsoever. I don't buy it. But they seem to have no reason to be with one another except for a shared attraction. You know, she's a bored small town girl, and maybe that's all that she needs. And I'm kind of hoping that that's it, because other than that, there's nothing to the character. Next day, Ben, having had enough of stalking young girls in the park, decides he's better harassing James Mason. So he decides to stalk him, who so far plays a Straker that's more paranoid than his novel counterpart, who always seemed to be in control of the situation. This Straker is very different from the book. He's still urbane and of high society, but Mason doesn't have that coiled strength as depicted in the novels. But this isn't a criticism, because it's James Mason. And he's able to imbue the character with enough life to make it memorable. I mean, he hams up the scenes and he just chews it up, which is great, because he just makes it something to watch. And there's not much in this movie that I would say is a reason to watch. But James Mason's portrayal, you know, he does a good job. It's definitely memorable. Unlike my boy, Mark. Ah, Mark, God, dude, you deserve better than this. Mark, you were a different sort of child, in the book, but in this, you know, he's aged up, in the movie, and is part of the Oscar-worthy production taking place at the high school, where Ben winds up meeting up with Mr. Burke, who apparently changed his name to Jason for test demographic reasons. I guess there were more Jasons in America at the time who could relate, or maybe there were just more English teachers by the name of Jason. Maybe Matt Burke was a bit more unrealistic. But I have to give Hooper credit for giving them the backstory of teacher and student. That it just makes sense to me, and that's something that I was reading the book. I thought that it would have... I kind of remembered them being, former student and teacher. I mean, it makes sense to me. I mean, if your main character is going to be from the small town and is a writer, and in the book he winds up teaming up with the high school English teacher, to me it makes more sense to add a little bit of that relationship and have him just be the former student. Props to Hooper. 10 points to you, sir, over Stephen King. So it's clear early on in the movie that Hooper and company have decided it would just make sense from a narrative standpoint to merge some of these characters to keep the film less cluttered. Whether it improves the film, we'll never know because it's not a good film, but I doubt it could have made it much worse. But at this point, when I was writing that particular note, I was only a half an hour in, and I was so bored, I wish a vampire would show up my window just to put me out of my misery. Maybe that's the sensibility, is a little out of step with what I've been used to over the last few years, but I'd argue that there are many classic movies from that time period and earlier that I could watch endlessly, but I'm telling you, this adaptation is not one of them. Ben and Jat, Jason, Matt, Burke, meet at a bar and they talk. I don't know what about, but I checked out. But apparently they talk and they wind up having another dinner scene because the first one was so engrossing. And then meanwhile, two characters are apparently transporting Barlow from across the country, considering the length of time it's taking for them to get to the Marston house. This movie films its scenes with such excruciating length and silence in the scenes, it is painful. And then Hooper films the Glick scene in the forest when the boy goes missing, like it's an alien abduction rather than a vampire attack, with swooping winds and, you know, the kid being blown back. It's not effective. I think that the shadow popping up, you know, it's a good little scare, but I don't understand how, and it's not even a vampire it's James Mason. It's James Mason, who apparently has control over wind and fauna. Now, while on the subject of the Glicks, it's Danny Glick, not Mark Petrie, who was visited by the vampire at the window scene. Now, I've been dumping all over this movie, but I will say this. I said that there's not too many reasons to check into this movie, but every time the boy vampires show up at the window, it is truly terrifying. I all joking aside, I'd say it's good enough. These scenes are good enough to justify watching the entire movie. The score, the cinematography, the staging, all work together to give you nightmares. Just the image, it's lit from behind through the fog, and just the way the fog swirls and ebbs and, you know, disappears and comes back, and just the way that, you know, the boy, you know, floats, it's awesome. You know, I mean, Hooper must have known from reading the script in the book that this was the scene that he needed to nail in order to give his movie any teeth. And yes, yeah, that was intended. But that's the highlight. Every time there's a window scene, that's the highlight. Unfortunately, the movie is never able to reach any sort of the heights of those particular scenes. Now, the rest of the movie just, you know, continues. I don't know. At this point, I'm just kind of rambling. We have Ben, who in the book was a blank character, played by a pretty blank actor who gives nothing to the character except annoyance at having to be in the movie in the first place. You know, and then I just kept thinking about what a stronger actor could have done. you know, and then I remember in the early 2000s, you know, how the world was just fascinated with Johnny Depp after, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean, and, you know, with all of his little tics and tricks that he would bring to a role. And so someone like that would have just had so much fun because he could just fill in all of those blank spaces with characteristics that weren't written into the script that would have been able to make the character worth watching. So, you know, David Soul and then later Rob Lowe just do not bring anything to this character. He wasn't much in the book, and he's not much in the movies. But I have to give him props. Dude has some serious phone acting in this movie. I mean, when he receives a call from Burke, I mean, when he's asked if he's Catholic, his response is, "Hell no, I'm Baptist." It's so annoyed. He brings a level of annoyed flavor to this role, especially when talking on the phone. It's like David Soul realizes at that moment how absurd this movie is and what he's being asked to do, and he just takes his contempt out on the scene. It's great. And this is right after he dismissively hangs up on Susan, who was clearly worried that he was going out to dinner with someone else. And he says, "No, I'm just going out with Jason." Pause. No, just Jason. And then he pretty much hangs up the phone, and the only thing missing from that scene is for him to mutter something about women and wink at the camera. So it's little things like that that I was able to get enjoyment out of, you know, the actor's complete disdain for being in this movie. But also, Ben, his responses. I mean, at one point, Mike Ryerson crashes into the table, which, by the way, could not have come at a better time. Ben was in the middle of talking about the Marston House being some kind of beacon, and boom! Here comes our boy, Mike Ryerson, with all the grace of Jason Biggs at a Malaysian Airlines memorial ceremony. Then Mike clearly becoming a vampire, so white he's basically green, two giant marks on his neck he keeps craning his neck to see, with all the subtlety of a woman just engaged, nonchalantly waving her hand around just so he can see the ring. He starts mumbling about sleeping in a graveyard, the bright scary eyes, and then says he wants a drink. Ben answers for him without even checking to see what he wants, and rather than, I don't know, maybe water for this clearly dehydrated guy, fires off, "Need a whiskey." Maybe it's just that the pure alcohol will just burn out the vampire germs. So that's our boy Ben. And a side note, when he enters the antique shop, I understand Hooper's decision to give Mark and Ben a moment between each other to foreshadow their destiny, but in that moment, it plays like Mark should expect to see Ben scratching at the window later that night for a completely different reason altogether than what Mark has seen before. And we got James Mason, who the entire time I just kept thinking of John Hamm from Saturday Night Live playing James Mason. Accent, the impression on the Vincent Price show, in which Bill Hader would play Vincent Price and Fred Armisen would play Liberace. And the entire time I'm watching James Mason, I kept picturing John Hamm as James Mason. But James Mason is perfect for the movie he is co-starring in, because dude just he's bringing life to an otherwise lifeless movie, you know, just driving a car like a champ, and you know, freaking out everyone he comes into contact with. James Mason, by the way, who has clearly been taking his vitamins, drinking his milk, and saying his prayers Hulk Hogan style, because he sticks Susan's dad on the wall like he's hanging a framed picture, then rips a stair post off the banister, which in that scene he doesn't really need. The dude's the Hulk. I mean, why do you need a stick when you're the Hulk? It's like trading in a bazooka for a handgun. But, you know, he goes out like a champ, taking a few bullets to the chest before tenderly touching the stair banister of his lovely domicile. A lot has been talked about, you know, book purists just don't really like what they did with Barlow. But to me, I don't really care. I think that adds a little bit of spice that the rest of the movie is lacking. And to be perfectly honest, anytime you give me a monster vampire, I'm totally fine with. You know, I mean, we're living in the day and age where there's still, you know, a bad taste in all of our mouths left over from the Twilight saga. And then, you know, even True Blood, you know, which is gory fun. The vampires are heartthrobs. and sex symbols, not monsters. So I mean, which isn't to say that our culture doesn't have, you know, monster vampires. You know, I mean, there was Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and right now it's the summer of 2014, and Guillermo del Toro's The Strain has been showing on FX, a show which I love because it's just creepy, gooey, ooey fun, where our vampires are just straight up monsters. I mean, look no further than I think episode 3 or 4, I don't remember which one is, but there's this great autopsy scene. Where there's no CGI except for some ammonia that squirts out of the vampire, but it's just the actors playing with these monster parts, and it's just great. It's just it adds a level of scare and just fun that's been missing from the vampire genre for a while. And you know, I mean, the fact that they wanted to go with the Nosferatu Max Schreck style vampire is fine because it differentiates the Straker Barlow you know, relationship. And then I saw a picture. I was looking at pictures of the 2004 edition of this movie, and if I will take the Max Schreck version of Barlow over soul patched Rutger Hauer any day. Or maybe not. Actually, I take that back. Anytime Rutger Hauer steps into the role of a villain, sign me up, because, you know, that guy knows how to choose scenery, soul patch and all. But yeah, I have no issues with Barlow being a monster. You know, the only issue I have is that when he storms the Petri kitchen, there's no reason, I guess, to just go after Father Callahan, just to take out the priest of the town. And when he shows up, by the way, it's like he's checking out the subwoofer in his Jeep before crashing through the window. And then the scene is just there. It you know, the only redeeming quality of that scene is James Mason's delivery of the word faith, because he literally says at one point, "It's time to face the master. It's face against face." Oh my God. And that's the scene. And then that's basically all we see of Marlow. Next time we see him, he's in the coffin. You know, and then everything else kind of just follows suit. Susan goes to the house, gets dispatched, you know, and turned into a vampire. And then what's cool is that we don't see her until the very end. They do change the ending, in which it goes back to Mexico, and Ben having, you know, started off the movie by saying that they're coming for him, enters his bedroom and Susan is there, and he has to put a stake through her heart, and that's how it ends, with them about to go on the run again. So that's my review of Salem's Lot the movie. It's not good, but I do recommend it for the window scenes. Everything about it, I think the music is super creepy in those scenes. Just the imagery is very, very disturbing. It's effective. It's very effective. So, I mean, check them out. I'm sure that if you just YouTubed it, you can see it and you can cut out the rest of the nonsense. So the only thing that I'm going to add is one thing that I wanted to add to the book review about some lasting influences that Salem's Lot has had on our culture. You know, like I said, you know, vampires are making a comeback, and you know, I think that, you know, some of the aspects can be felt a little bit in The Strain, you know, from just how quickly everything spreads. You know, I'm sure that a little bit of Salem's Lot had, you know, influence on some level Joss Whedon as he wrote Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I think that the most obvious one that you could see is The Lost Boys. But there are three books that I really need to plug. Three horror novels that do not get any sort of recognition whatsoever. I've never encountered anyone that has read them, outside of, you know, my circle of friends that have happened to read them, because I found one day, and that's the Pine Deep trilogy by Jonathan Mabberry, which I describe to people as the best books that Stephen King never wrote. His style is very much Stephen King, but not just Stephen King, because a lot of people imitated Stephen King. I don't think he's imitating. I think that he just has a style that's very similar. But it reminded me of King at the height of his his writing years. And these novels are good. And so basically it's three books. It's a trilogy, all about a small Pennsylvania town in Pine Deep, which I'm just going to read you the what it says on Wikipedia. The Pine Deep trilogy is a series of supernatural horror novels by Jonathan Madbury. The series set in Pine Deep, a fictional rural Pennsylvania town that becomes plagued by an evil force thought previously killed 30 years ago. In the books, the town is considered to be the most haunted town in America and has a booming supernatural tourism industry based around the town's history and Halloween. The trilogy is composed of Ghost Road Blues, Dead Man's Song, and Bad Moon Rising. The first book in the series, Ghost Road Blues, won the Bram Stoker Award for the Best First Novel in 2006 and was one of Complex Magazine's 25 Best Horror Novels of the New Millennium. I strongly, strongly recommend these books. It has, in some ways, a Salem's Lot feel. You know, something's happening to the town. The townspeople don't know exactly why, and it's up to a small group of townspeople to put an end to it before it's too late. So go out, stop what you're doing, just order them on Amazon, have them come to your house, or go out to Barnes & Noble. I only think that Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, will have them. But like I said, these are the best books that Stephen King never wrote. Jonathan Madbury does a bang-up job, and I just needed to end this podcast positively because, the movie didn't do it for me. So that's all we've got for this week. Stay tuned next week as I go back into Stephen King's texts and review his third book, the very famous haunted house story set in the Overlook Hotel, the one, the only, The Shining. Have a great week, and I'll see you here, same King time, same King channel, Stephen King.